So we'll get going. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Why don't we, can someone move the minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the minutes of August 21st and July 25th.
All right. Representative Carlson moves the July 25th and August 21st meeting minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. So today we're going to start looking at some of these advisory groups and task forces, et cetera. So I want to thank Representative Holberg, first of all, for volunteering to help out with this small group, which will save us all. And I'm going to do it too, which is all save us some time. We could use a couple senators. Senator Newman, all right, there we go. And we're just waiting for you guys. So. Okay, we'll figure that out. Okay. So hopefully what we'll do is come back, and we're not, you know, well, the first thing is, you know, they're all listed on the LCPFP website. All the responses we've gotten are posted there, so if people want to go and look at that. We're going to have Mr. Shepherd go through kind of the language of what we're going to be focused on. And then, you know, the idea, I don't think we'll take any action as we move along until we kind of get a final package pulled together. Hopefully, the smaller group, we can sit down and, you know, put them into buckets where we know we're going to keep something. They're like the pen, you know, the board, the State Investment Board will probably want to keep that going. And then some that we know we probably want to just get rid of easily because the agency wants to get rid of it. And then there'll be this bucket in the middle that we can come back to the commission with. At a future meeting. So, why don't Mr. Shepherd, do you want to get going? Just get us started here with a quick overview.
Yep. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Mark Shepherd from the House Research Department, and the chair asked me to just briefly do two things. One, to just remind you of what the new 2013 law said that charged you to do this. And second, to just give a little bit of background about things that apply to all the executive branch advisory groups. So the 2013 law did a couple of things. It required this group by September 1st of each odd-numbered year, it's an ongoing duty, to compile a list of executive branch advisory groups that are created in statute. They're permanent enough that they are codified in statute. And you did that. At your last meeting, you adopted a list, which is in your packets, and I believe today. But anyway, you've created the list, and as Speaker Thiessen indicated, the groups that are on that list are now posted on the LCPFP website. Second, the statute said that the commission may develop a schedule for review of the advisory groups, or it could select particular groups for review. What? And by December 31st of each odd-numbered year, again, an ongoing duty, the commission may make recommendations on the continuing need for groups. The law gave a little bit of guidance for the commission to follow when it's doing this review. The commission's required to consider what the mission is of each group, the extent to which the group is effective in allowing people who are interested in the agency activities to have input into the operation of the activities, because some of these groups were created basically to give voice to stakeholder groups that the legislature felt otherwise wouldn't have a voice in front of the agency. Second, the law asked this group to consider the extent to which the existence of the advisory group provides agencies with a way of getting expert advice and opinions. As Speaker Thiessen mentioned, there's an advisory group to the State Board of Investment that is basically investment professionals from a number of major firms around town that give free advice to the State Board of Investment. So that's probably the best example of a group that's giving an agency free services. Then the law requires this group to decide if there's more efficient or effective means of accomplishing the work of the group and whether there's overlap or duplication. I'm next going to talk just very briefly about a memo that's in your packet. It's entitled General Laws Governing Advisory Groups, and this is something that would apply as you're considering all the groups, either today or in the small group proceedings later. In the mid-1970s, the legislature enacted a set of laws that could be referenced by the legislature when they are creating advisory groups in hope that this would promote uniformity. And so that law, Minnesota Statute 15.059, provided some common nomenclature. For example, groups that are short-term in nature are supposed to be called task forces, whereas other groups could be called councils or committees. Section 15.059 does not automatically apply. It applies only when the legislature says that it is going to apply to a particular group. So this is kind of a shorthand that the legislature can refer to if it wants to. And when it does that, then there's provisions that govern the membership terms of advisory councils. These are set up with four-year terms, with roughly half of the members serving coterminous with the governor and the other half on the opposite two-year cycle. Interestingly, for these advisory groups, all of the members serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority, can be removed for any reason. So these groups are different from occupational licensing boards, where the members can be removed only for cause and are intended to have terms that would overlap the terms of the governor. When the legislature provides that this law applies, then these members of advisory groups get compensation, and that is $55 a day per diem for time spent on activities, plus reimbursement for expenses. Again, this applies only when the legislature says that Section 15.059 applies. There's also authority for the groups to get reimbursed for expenses in the same amount and manner as state employees, so for meals or travel. One provision that would be of interest to this group is that for a time, the legislature periodically established in Section 15.059 a general expiration date for advisory groups. If a group is a task force, if it's named a task force, it expires after 2 years, unless a commissioner decides to extend it. But for other groups, the legislature periodically, for a number of times through the 80s, 90s, and in the last decade, had a general expiration date for advisory groups and said that groups would expire on a particular date. The last time this occurred was on June 30th, 2009. More recently, when the legislature has created groups, it has established an expiration date right in the law creating the group. And so this general sunset date of June 30th, 2009 doesn't apply to that many groups anymore. And one reason that the legislature has decided to enact a specific date for each group is it's less confusing. The people who are interested in the group can look at the law creating the group and see when it expires. And as you'll hear from some of the agencies through the process of reviewing these groups, the general June 30th, 2009 expiration date has caused some confusion, either because it wasn't clear with respect to a particular group or because the people didn't know about it. The legislature in general has moved toward just specifying an expiration date for each group right in the law. Mr. Chair, that concludes my opening overview, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? All right. Mr. Erdman, thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Welcome. And Ms. Tollefson, right? Yes.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Edmond. I'm a director of Explorer.
No R.
Yep. That's quite all right. Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting us to address some of the questions that you posed of us regarding the Explorer Minnesota Tourism Council. Staff gave us a few questions to address, and I'll try to generally talk about that right now. But first of all, the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council, Explore Minnesota as an agency, was created in 2004. We used to be part of the Department of Trade and Economic Development and then Department of Economic Security, but we created a separate agency. The legislature created a separate agency to guide tourism efforts in Minnesota. And a tourism council was created as an advisory group at that time. in order to help provide advice in the direction of our programs. All members, as Mr. Shepherd had pointed out, are in that situation where they're appointed by the governors on staggering terms. We have 28 members on our council representing all different aspects of the tourism industry, whether they be hotels, resorts, regional associations, chambers, tour operators, etc. There are also four legislative members on our council, two from the House, two from the Senate, one from each body. And it's a they're very effective and engaged council and helpful to us. Now, the budget for the council, and actually the amount that we spent is about $5,400. Members serve without compensation. There is no per diem. We don't reimburse for travel. All that money basically covers is we have four meetings a year, roughly, and those meetings usually take place during a lunch hour. We pay for the lunch. We have one overnight occasionally every few years to do some strategic planning, but that's it for the expenses for the council. And there's no additional funds, frankly, are needed. Everyone is fully participating and happy to serve on the council. We don't draw any alternative sources of funding. Frankly, we don't need it. As an agency, we have to bring in about $5.5 million in private sector match, but we don't use any of that to avoid any kind of conflict of interest. And it's really an invaluable tool for us as an agency. It's efficient, and they provide critical planning we couldn't do without. The council, they do provide their opinions very freely. They often participate in various task forces. And the nice thing about it is when I'm trying to get some opinions on a direction, all aspects of our tourism industry is represented in one place. We can get feelers out on certain types of directions of things that we where we want to go. As far as others who have not participated, we had talked about this internally. The only other industry sector that isn't currently represented is the car rental industry. There was a lot of discussion about that in the last legislative session, and that's one area that we could potentially add to have represented on the council. But other than that, our industry is very, very broad and well represented. So they do provide key advice. Just a couple examples from advertising. We received some new funding this last session, and it was with the council's direction. We decided to go out to a new ad agency, RFP, and they help with decisions on crafting grant programs, and they're really critical in our strategic planning. That's one of the very key things that they do is they help us provide the direction on where we want to go as an agency, and then we provide all the details to do that. We hold regular industry meetings, sometimes task forces beyond the council, but the council provides us with a single voice. Without that, we wouldn't have that one place we could go to. They do all that asked, and there really are no unfulfilled duties because there's really no other group that effectively represents all aspects of the industry. There's different state associations, hotel associations, resort associations, et cetera, but no one place where they can all come together in an unbiased manner. So the bottom line question, do you believe the council should be continued? Yes, we think it should be continued. They act as a voice of the industry. They're a great source of advice. And there's little need to increase any effectiveness with the council.
Any questions people have on this one?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Evan, maybe not quite to the council, but now with the increase in funding at the council, how do we compare to our kind of neighboring states in the Midwest as to the amount of resources the state commits to tourism promotion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, we were before this increase ranked about 30th in the country. I'm not sure what the current ranking is with the increased dollars, but that puts us at about $13.9 million a year. We're still a little bit lower than Wisconsin, our competitors. We're lower than Michigan, Missouri. I mean, those states have big budgets, upwards of the $50 million. But this will put us at a level where we are now able to compete with our competitors. Because as you know, Senator, we see a lot of advertising from other states that are targeting Minnesota, and we haven't been able to compete with that to capture market share. So we'll have a new ranking probably in another few months, and I'll be able to give you a specific answer for that. We definitely have moved up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Edmund, and I may have missed it in your comments, but I'm assuming that the council meets periodically, and maybe they have a regular scheduled meeting cycle. I'm not sure if that's true or not. Is that the case, or is it just an ad hoc kind of a meeting?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the council meets regularly four times a year. We already set the schedule for the meetings for 2014, and occasionally we have some other task forces and ad hoc meetings that aren't as scheduled, but we do have four regularly scheduled meetings here.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, and Mr. Edmund, I was just looking at the list of council members, and I think part of your comment was that it's an opportunity for a lot of different voices to be represented in one body. It's unclear that they would all agree on specific things. Maybe they do, I don't know. But I could imagine that there'd be some things that some would think would be good and others would think not so good. So what kind of recommendations does the council provide? Could you give us any examples of some of the recommendations the council has provided that have been sort of instances of the work that they've done to
certainly
as a body?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, probably the most important thing the council does is help us with our strategic planning. We often bring in an outside facilitator, and that facilitator formulates some questions about the direction for tourism, and it's more specifically about where should we invest our dollars? Should we be looking at strengthening our drive markets? Should we be looking to expand into new markets? What about international markets? We've had some questions that we've posed to them about partnership programs and co-ops, and what about grant programs? How do they help small organizations in the state versus other organizations? So we provide them some very broad opportunities, foundation to talk about strategic direction and planning. But then at various times during the year, we might have a question that's a little bit more minor in scope about creating a tourism Hall of Fame award or things like that. So it starts out very broad, but it can get detailed. The thing that, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that I like about the council is that not only to represent all aspects of the industry, but if we as an agency aren't sure, then we know there's different opinions, we can bring it to the council and they can give us that direction. And rarely, yes, we have a lot of lively discussion, but we come together a lot as an industry. So I feel good about the direction that I'm going because I know I have the council direction and advice to lead us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Edmund, I think, you know, part of our review is just to see if the current structure is the best possible. And I know you have a large group, but it looks like a lot of it is vendors, you know, lodging, campgrounds, et cetera. And I think that, you know, maybe we need to have, you know, sort of expand maybe some of the things that people come here. For example, there's no one representing the arts industry, and yet that, you know, people coming to the Guthrie, and hopefully we'll be able to retain a world-class orchestra that attracts people from even outside the state. You know, I don't see that kind of interest represented, and, you know, it's always surprising to many people, but, you know, about more than, I think it's about two-thirds of the tourism is actually in the metro area, and to just have one metro representative trying to struggle with, you know, professional sports, professional arts, people who are coming for the Minnesota Zoo, you know, whatever it is, I think that's asking a lot. So, I mean, if you've got recommendations on voices that you don't feel are being heard, we'd certainly be open to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think those are some very good thoughts about adding to the council. The council is large, but it's not so large that it's not workable. Adding to arts, as I mentioned, rental car industry or other aspects of our industry, we'll certainly be open. I'd be open to that to get, you know, a stronger voice. We do, as far as the I just want to mention, as far as the metro representative, there's five regions of the state that are represented, and one of those is metro. But a lot of those other categories include representatives from the metro area, the convention bureaus or the bed and breakfasts or the hotels and things like that. Those are people that are actually from the metro area. So it's not just one individual. That's just the individual that's the metro is the, of the five regions, one of them is the metro region. But we'd be open to looking at it, expanding. Those are good comments.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Ms. Grimes, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. We have two legislatively mandated advisory groups, the Higher Education Data Advisory Task Force and the Student Advisory Council. Both have been in existence for many years. And the mission of these groups is ongoing. We continue to need input from the data advisory group on how to implement data requests, and we have new requests from the legislature, almost every biennium, about data they want for accountability in post-secondary education. And we value the chance to listen to the perspectives of student leaders at the Student Advisory Council. The councils do not have explicitly a budget. We do not pay per diems or travel. The participants in these advisory groups view this participation as part of their jobs or their elected leadership position for the student leaders. In terms of efficiency and effectiveness, given that there's no explicit budget, it's kind of hard to think about how to be more efficient, but we do allow participants to participate by phone if they are unable to come into the office, for example, because they are a student from a greater Minnesota campus. And we certainly would be able to do the same thing by Skype if we decided that that was the way that people wanted to participate. From our point of view, the advisory councils have been an efficient means to obtain advice and opinions. We do not anticipate the need for other stakeholders to be added to the groups. The recommendations of the groups are incorporated into the agency's ongoing policies and practices. In many ways, they're really conversations, two-way conversations, where we're sharing information and they're sharing advice and opinions. And individuals from the task forces regularly provide feedback to the agency as individuals and also in the meetings of the task forces and council. In the absence of the task force and council, the agency would continue to seek input from the people who are members of those groups through meetings and contacts with the individuals. There is some overlap between the Data Advisory Task Force and the data group that operates under the mandate of the P20 Education Group. In the last 2 years, they have been developing the statewide longitudinal education data system that will track data on students from K-12 schools into post-secondary and into the workforce. So there is some overlap there, but we think both groups are necessary because there are different questions that come up when you're tracking data on students all the way through their K-12 and post-secondary career than there is when you're just dealing with the post-secondary institutions. We do think the advisory groups should be continued. We will be recommending two tweaks in the terminology used for the Student Advisory Council because there is a reference to a student group in the Minnesota Private Colleges and Universities that is no longer in existence, and so we would just want to specify that a student representing that sector be appointed. And there's also some obsolete language in the reference to the students from the for-profit colleges. Again, they don't typically get referred to as vocational schools anymore, so we would propose to change that just to a general reference to a student representing that sector. One question we had is the Data Advisory Council didn't meet for 2 years, and do we really need it if it didn't meet for 2 years? Well, that was the years when the statewide longitudinal education data system was being developed under the auspices of the P20 Education Partnership, and so many of the same people were involved in those meetings. And when you see them at one set of meetings, you tend to catch them in the aisle or whenever and ask the questions that you need to ask that you might have needed to do in a separate meeting if it weren't for the fact that the SLEDS group was meeting. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Carlson.
Ms. Grimes, I'm curious that looking at the review here, it says to meet with the commissioner or the commissioner's designee. And this didn't involve your agency, but and no current leadership, but at one time students were quite frustrated when they couldn't meet with the leadership of one of the systems, and it was always the designee, and they felt that they were being short-circuited. So my question is basically, is it the designee or the commissioner that typically meets with the students?
Well, the commissioner, at least once every 3 months, now has a policy of meeting with the Student Advisory Council himself in person. And he, those are relatively informal conversations with the group, but they have a good back-and-forth exchange. So that is certainly the policy of this commissioner.
Okay, this was ancient history, but it did surface in the legislature with the students' frustration a while back. And
right.
So thank you.
So what is the aggregate and distributional financial data? I mean, what is that used for?
Well, for example, we collect data every 2 years from every institution on all of the different kinds of financial aid programs their students receive aid, the total amount received and total number of recipients. And that helps us get perspective on, for example, how the Minnesota State Grant Program compares to what students are receiving from federal Pell Grants and also from institutional scholarships, whether the institutions are making loans to their own students, how federal loans and state loans stack up, all that kind of thing. So that's one of the primary examples of that kind of data.
And so what decisions do you make with that data then?
We put that data certainly on our website, and in much of that ends up in the Minnesota Measures Report, which we make to the legislature on accountability. It helps us provide a context for what the state dollars do. I'm not sure I can point to a specific decision on that behalf, but years ago when I first started collecting the data, the state grant program was about the same size as the institutional scholarships, and now over time the institutional scholarships have grown to be 5 or 6 times as large as the state grant program. So it sort of gives us a sense of how much sort of leverage is available through the state funds as opposed to the institutional scholarship money.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that the majority of your people on this data advisory task are also on the SLEDS group. Is there an opportunity to just combine them?
Representative Holberg, that's certainly a possibility. However, the focus of the SLEDS group is a little different than the focus of the higher education group. One of the questions that has come up over time, for example, is that the state funds approximately 80% of what goes on at the school districts, and so when the state wants new data from the school districts tend to feel like they just have to provide it. When it comes to post-secondary education, there's that whole academic freedom and independence thing, and so we have to really work with the sectors to talk through with them what the data is needed for and how it should be collected and all that sort of thing, and then we end up with data sharing agreements where the colleges actually sign on the bottom line what we're going to do with the data and how it's going to be used and how we're going to protect data privacy. So there's really a different kind of emphasis.
If I might, Mr. Chair,
yes.
How much overlap is there? How many members serve on both? And
I'm thinking here for a minute. I would guess it's a little more than half are on both. The ones that are not on the Higher Education Data Advisory Council would be the ones from DEED and the ones from Minnesota Department of Education and the sectors that report to Minnesota Department of Education.
But if I might, all of those on your higher ed group, is the entirety of your data advisory group on SLEDS as well?
No, I don't believe so. I'm just trying to think. I would have to double check that and get back to you. I'm sorry.
All right. Thank you.
So do you have data sharing agreements in place now with all these institutions?
We do, yes.
And do those change? Are they uniform?
They are uniform, but they do change from time to time. For example, when it comes to some of the SLEDS data, originally when we started getting it from the post-secondary institutions, we had said that we would not disclose the data institution by institution. It would just be by sector. And since then, the Senate got put in the appropriations bill some language asking for information that would be institution by institution. So we will be redoing those data sharing agreements with the institutions to, provide for the disclosure of that data by institution. And the institutions, since they're already reporting it to us, it's not an additional burden for them to report it again to the Senate.
So the agreements are all uniform for the data sharing related to the loans here.
Right.
And when's the last time those agreements were changed?
I think about 3 years ago as SLEDS was developing, the Statewide Longitudinal Education Data System.
Oh, it's a single agreement that covers SLEDS and this grant
yes,
and loan.
Yes, that is true, yes.
Okay. And prior to that, when was the last time those agreements were changed?
I would have to double-check and get back to you, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Okay. Any other? Yes, Senator Noble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In going through the letter that you had sent to Chair Thiessen, it looks like, you know, almost all of the membership in this task force and in the Student Council Advisory Council, you know, are all employees in some form or fashion in higher ed. And then the letter goes on to say that the reports and recommendations of the task force are included in the report from the Office of Higher Education. And I understand that there isn't a specific budget for this task force, but obviously just having employees go to a meeting and attend meetings and seminars, it does cost money because they're on salary. Mm-hmm. So my question is given the fact that this task force is incorporating its findings and recommendations in your report, and given the fact that they are already involved in, you know, the members are already involved in higher education, why is it necessary to have a statutorily created task force as opposed to the Office of Higher Education simply, you know, setting a date for a seminar or a meeting or whatever and inviting the various players to come to the meeting and provide the input? Why do we need the separate statutorily created task force?
Ms. Graham.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, perhaps we don't. The agency probably would, in fact, continue to meet with the same people in the absence of the language. It's an important conversation to be having with the institutions, but if the legislation weren't there, it would probably proceed very similarly. When it comes to the Student Advisory Council, the students who are leaders from their sectors, for example, the Minnesota State University Student Association and the Minnesota Community College Student Association, are not employees of their institutions. They represent the students on those campuses.
That's a good clarification. So the one thing that I see from reading this language is really, it looks to me like the reason that this task force was set up, because it's hardly even set up in the language, was to provide a check on the Office of Higher Education on just kind of dictating what information is going to come from the institutions. More that it's almost a check on you more mm-hmm. than it is participation mm-hmm. from the task forces, but it seems like you maybe can get the same place with these agreements that are in place that you'd have to negotiate anyway.
Mr. Chair, that is another avenue. When people want data, you know, the students the data is about don't always fit neatly into the boxes, and so we have to have conversations about when is a student part-time or when is a student considered an online student and things like that. And sometimes we find we really learn from that back and forth exchange, because collecting the data in one way may be quite burdensome when in fact there's another piece of data that's available that's much less burdensome for the institutions to report.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions on this one? All right. Thank you very much. That's helpful. Representative Loeffler, I'm sorry, there is one more question.
Sorry, I thought you meant a question. Were there any more questions on the data part?
Oh, no.
The Student Advisory Council, I think, is important for students to have input into financial aid and how we're thinking about that. But I noted that this isn't one where we actually do pay the per diem. And I'm thinking, you know, a student who's representing MinSCU and is a student at Bemidji State or whatever, it might be a real expense for them to have to come down to a meeting and participate. And do the institutions typically help cover those costs, or is that one that we should actually think about addressing so that students can afford to serve on these kind of things?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, it's my understanding that the student associations generally reimburse the students for their costs, so it comes out a tiny bit of fee revenue.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. The Department of Veterans Affairs folks, welcome. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike McKelney, Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And with me today, I have Senior Director of Programs and Services, Brad Lindsay, which I'm going to turn the microphone over to him here shortly. He was actually one of the members of the committee that we're talking about today.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Mike said, I served on this committee initially as the representative of the County Veterans Service Officers Association back in 2007. We saw primarily the purpose of this. If you remember, we were establishing the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Higher Education Veterans Program, as well as the Minnesota GI Bill. So we were kind of a task force or committee that was involved in facilitating that new program between the department, the National Guard, and all of the higher learning institutions.
And can I just, I'm sorry, and there's two that we're going to be talking about today, the healthcare one and the higher education one, and now we're on the higher education
one.
That
is correct.
Okay, thank you.
My apologies.
Just to get me oriented. Thank you.
Sure. Basically, Mr. Chair, we met for about a year back in 2007. Once we got the campus rep or higher education program established throughout the state and had those relationships built, Minnesota GI Bill was in place. We had a final meeting, and at that time we just basically declared that we were not going to meet further until something came up in the future, if that ever happened. To date, that hasn't happened, so really the committee has been inactive since 2007 or January of 2008, I believe, after we submitted the first legislative report. So.
And do you know, can you tell us what's happened with that legislative report and what's happening kind of in general on the issue?
Well, Mr. Chair, basically the department took over that legislative report, and it has been submitted each year since by the department to the Office of Legislation.
And are we having success, like substantively, instead of not just the report, but in terms of achieving the goals?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. We've seen quite an uptick in the number of student veterans who are attending school and also graduating school. I do have my subject matter expert along with me today, too. If we have any very specific questions, our Dave Bellify is my supervisor, who was one of the original coordinators as well when the program was established. So we can get a little deeper if you'd like. So.
Well, I'll leave that to the rest of the commission. Representative or Senator Lord.
Thank you. I mean, I guess the question needs to be asked. Do you recommend that it's sitting here in our statute books as a creation with no expiration date at all. Would you recommend that we just leave that sit there without it meeting, or would you recommend that we clean up the statute books and if a need arises, we have a discussion around it at the legislature and reintroduce it?
Mr. Chair,
have a preference?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe we felt that our goals had been met. Once those relationships between the institutions and the department and the Guard and Office of Higher Education was established, those are ongoing. So I don't think we really have the need. You know, one of the issues we had back then, just a simple issue, is the legislation says that space has to be provided at the institutions for our campus reps. Well, some institutions took that as a resource center and office space, and other ones took it as, you know, a small piece of a bulletin board somewhere in a hallway. So that's really what the committee did, was to facilitate what that meant and to get things cleared up and get it in place. I think now we have those conversations daily with the other entities, so I don't really see a need for the committee to go on further. And like I said, it hasn't met since, I believe, January of 2008. So.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think as we review these, I think one of the things we should think about, and this is kind of an example, is just, you know, how well the state does kind of customer service surveying. Because, I mean, this is really an institutional group. But really what we want to know as policymakers is how are the students served, and do they feel like they're served well? And you don't have to have an advisory committee for that. You can have, you know, regular surveying of people who participated in the programs. And I think we had a, as we're reviewing these, think about whether there's other input method, you know, methods than just having a committee that meets. And we might get broader input from a more representative group of people.
Have you heard back from students at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think we do any formal. Dave?
Yes.
Do we do a formal?
The institution by institution.
Oh, all right. Yeah, it's not a process that the Department of Veterans Affairs per se does, but as Dave says, we do it. Some institutions do that, but that would be definitely something we could look into expanding.
Okay. Any further questions on the higher ed piece? Okay. What about the Healthcare Advisory Council? Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you, Mr.
And Mr. Chair, we have Deputy Commissioner Mike Gallucci, Veterans Healthcare, is going to address the Advisory Council piece.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Speaker, members of the committee. I believe in front of you, you should have received a packet, or at least a letter, I should say, dated April 3rd, 2013. Just a little historical background. When I came in March of 2012, right after session of 2012, we started. We've met with this committee on a quarterly basis prior to my arrival. Discussions in earnest after the Minnesota summer of 2012 as to where we should go, knowing that this was coming by statute on a sunset in June of 2013. So we engaged the advisory council probably in the December timeframe as the direction that they felt. And as you can see by this letter dated the 3rd of April that we sent to the governor's office, it was a consolidated thought by the advisory council that it had met its mission. Its original charge was to look strategically out and develop a number of things to include improving of healthcare long-term wise. But in our discussion with the advisory council, both they and the agency felt that it was important that there be some successor to the entire process. But one of the things that they felt frustrated, as apparently the agency did as well, was that it was somewhat stagnant as an advisory council. We had members that were not currently in the direct healthcare world, but were very familiar with it. And it really ended up being more of a briefing session than it was looking forward. So our approach to the advisory council, and ultimately, as you can see by the letter, was a recommendation that we would move away from a statutorily created advisory council to a more flexible commissioner task force, since the commissioner by Minnesota statute has the authority to create one, that would allow us to not only have a broader participation of stakeholders that are currently in healthcare or veterans issues, but also to be able to then develop a smaller focus group so that if we wanted to concentrate on a particular item, such as some of those that are below in this letter, we felt that they could then independently work, come back to the task force and brief the agency so that we could actually develop a true blueprint, if you will, for healthcare in the next 10 years. We didn't wish to abandon long-term care, obviously, because that is the principal business that we're in, but we also recognize the requirement that Minnesota has to be able to look out dealing with issues that are on the cusp. And so we thought we would change up our membership. So, for instance, in this new task force, our proposal which the commissioner and the agency thought of, was that we would include the VAMC here locally, the Veterans Medical Center. They have offered to give us their operations officer to sit on the board. That's an important tie-in because we are tied to the hip, both financially and with the same population. We've also gone back again to Minnesota's Aging Services, who has been a great supporter of the home programs and an advisory, and asked for their ability to help us locate a couple of long-term care personnel that would like to sit on the committee. We've also solicited through Aging Services and through other venues resumes for social workers and psychologists as we start to address some of the issues that are going to be faced with not only with our current residents of aging adults, but also with the forthcoming of newer veterans, if you will, and the medical problems that we have. We've invited the Veterans Integrated Service District, VISN 23, so that we would then also maintain VISN 23 is a group of all the state veterans' homes serving states around, to include Minnesota, as well as the VA sits on that list. What that does is give us the ability to understand what our neighboring state veterans' homes are seeing and be able to learn from best practices that they have. Plus, along with the VAMC and the VISN, which is connected directly to D.C., we'll be able to stay abreast of veterans' issues and veterans' programs that are there and have direct input. One of the successes that we're already seeing in that partnership is the development of telehealth. We'll be the first group to do that in state veterans' homes, as well as electronic health records, which is not being done anywhere in the nation. So we're already starting to see a little bit of payoff on this. Additionally, we've been asked for a member of the commander's task force, which is representative of all the VSOs, veteran service organizations in the state, to be a member so that now we're also seeing what they're seeing as they work through with serving their veterans. And last, the thing that we're looking for, hopefully, is that we have not approached them yet, but we're hoping that the Department of Health will also provide us with somebody to sit on there so that we have a state input as well. And next week, I think it is, that I have a meeting with the Minnesota Guard to talk to them about the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. And if we can get somebody from their organization to sit on that, we think that that also brings us and ties us closer to community so that we understand those things that we're not necessarily seeing overall. The whole purpose of this task force at the end of the day is to not only continue to support the long-term care initiative that we're doing and we are sustaining that, but also to look for ways that the industry is improving from a federal and state agency level, but also then to hear from more broader group of stakeholders that we have. So I know that this is already sunset in June of 2013, but we want to assure you and the members that our goal, not only in this venue, but as we also work with your subcommittee to find ways for us to address the issues and the needs of veterans, not only in their age, but also before they become aging.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, just a question. In reading the letter of April 3rd, you talk about retiring the current council. And if you'll recall, when staff, Mr. Shepherd, went over the laws that govern councils and task forces, he pointed out that a task force typically lasts for 2 years.
Yes, sir.
And you referenced a planning process, if I understood you correctly, over a period of 10 years. So would you envision this task force being reconstituted every 2 years?
That's what we're asking for. And I think what that does is give – I'm sorry. my decorum.
No, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. I think what this does is allows us to keep the committee fresh and also flexible enough, because healthcare overall is changing faster than we can keep our eyes on it. And I think what happens is this will allow us to be able to not only look long range, 10 years, but also, if you will, see what is actually facing Minnesota veterans right now. And one of the things that we learned over the last year and a half is that, for instance, a revamp of our domiciliaries is important. If we're trying to work through a continuum of care, a revamp of the program that addresses the problems that they're facing there within the home, but also then develop the programs that we can to push them to see if they can become independent livers and move out of domiciliary.
So, Mr. Chairman, the main reason I asked the question was just to see what you're comfortable with in terms of reconstituting it every 2 years, and it sounds like you are.
That's what we would, our goal is, yes, sir.
Thank you.
So just to clarify, just for everyone, so this council is actually gone. It expired on June 30th.
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
And this task force you want to establish, you don't need us to do anything on that? You're just going to do it through the commissioner's authority?
As I checked with the attorney general, so yes, we would do it through the office of the commissioner.
Okay. Representative Loughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you're looking at it, as the April memo indicates that two of the five emphases of the task force would be women's programs and sexual assault trauma. And I'm not that familiar with all the military organizations, so I'm not as familiar with all the groups that you indicated would be involved, but I would think you would want to potentially seriously think about a separate group that would deal with this. I've heard from women veterans that in male-dominated groups, they're just not comfortable talking and exploring options in the same way as they might be with a group of victims who might be more comfortable sharing with each other their issues and experiences and maybe advise to the bigger group.
Mr. Speaker, Representative, thank you. These comments here, these areas, really are broad areas, and our goal is to have those smaller focus groups, because sexual assault is not just isolated to females. And so that's why we wanted to bring on some very specified social workers, psychologists, that then could break down into smaller groups and come back as it more as a focused working group that can come back and give us timely advice as opposed to every quarter just meeting.
Thank you.
Senator Lurie.
You know, before we move on, I know it says that this list that includes women's assault programs and sexual assault trauma is not an exclusive list, but one thing I recall, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, Department of Veterans Affairs study that really highlighted the high incidence of traumatic brain injury for returning vets, and I'd encourage you to really dig down to that too, because the diagnoses of that is very, very difficult, and I know that service members returning struggle mightily with that particular ailment. And,
Mr. Speaker, Senator, you're absolutely correct. In fact, just this past week, Minneapolis hosted the VISN here and had a considerable presentation on traumatic brain injury. And having worked with Wounded Warriors, I'm very, very familiar with both that and post-traumatic stress. Correct.
Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Assistant Commissioner Kelly or someone from MMB is there. Oh, welcome. So, Minnesota Management and Budget, how are you?
We're doing well, thank you.
Good.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division. I'll be covering the first two committees as listed on the agenda. The first one relates to the Minnesota Employee Insurance Program, or a program that was referred to as MEEP. that was created in 1992. Actually, both of these programs were created around the same time. This one was created in 92. It was intended to provide coverage for small employers. This was intended to be a private sector purchasing pool. The program, unfortunately, never gained traction and hasn't really been in existence since about 1998. That was the last group that had left. So, therefore, there is no advisory committee that's currently meeting for this program. The second program is referred to as PEEP. That's the Public Employee Insurance Program. PEEP is still in existence. It provides health and dental and life coverage for employees of local units of government. So this is sort of the public sector counterpart to the MEEP program. It was created in 1989. It currently has 93 participating public sector employers for and includes about 15,000 lives. To put that into some perspective, the current CGIP program that you're all a part of, it has over 120,000 lives. So relatively speaking, a pretty small pool. And the committee in the early days was a part of helping to set up the PEEP program, creating the plan designs. There were literally over 100 different combinations of plans, co-pays, deductibles that various public sector employers could choose from, and therefore is very complicated to administer, and the advisory group was very important to just sort of managing that and getting the program up and running. However, since about 2003, the program really has dovetailed on the CGIP program. That's the one for state employees. And so, therefore, the administration of the program really follows the state program that we're all participants of. Therefore, the committee hasn't convened since about 2003. We do still continue to post in case anybody is interested. It is an advisory committee only. It doesn't have any decision-making authority. But to date, and since 2003, we've never had a qualified candidate show any interest in the program. So, therefore, it hasn't met, like I said, since about 2003.
Any questions on this one? So is MEEP still in statute, the whole program?
Mr. Chair, yes, both the MEEP is still in statute, yes. It's an optional program for the commissioner to implement if they should so choose.
And they would just offer a series of insurance options that small businesses could pool their employees basically to create a better, to negotiate better? Is that the idea?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it was really intended to just pool the resources, both in terms of purchasing power, in terms of risk management, in terms of, you know, negotiating contracts with health plans, providers, much in the same way that the state employee program works today. But unfortunately, you know, as a voluntary pool,
only sick people went in there.
Employers that really had basically couldn't get decent products in the marketplace would come in, and it was more of a financial stability issue in terms of its going away rather than any administrative issue. It couldn't remain solvent.
Okay.
Chair?
Yes. Senator Sanchez.
Chair, and so just to summarize, if the worst possible outcome of repealing these two committees would be fairly minimal, I take it, almost non-existent.
Mr. Chair and members, it would be fairly minimum, but I guess I would leave that to the wisdom of the legislature to decide what it deemed best there.
Mr. Chair, does the agency have any preference?
I don't think that we have a preference. We certainly, if
it hasn't met though for
it hasn't met, and like I said, we do follow our statutory obligation to post for interested members, and you know if you want us to continue to do that, we'll do that. If not, we can.
But to go one step further, we're talking about repealing just the advisory committee. It sounds like we could repeal all of the MEEP.
That'll be for your committee.
Exactly. I mean, I've never even heard of the thing before. it might be broader than just repealing an advisory committee on this one. We could probably clean up the statute books even more, and the advisory committee would go away by virtue of getting rid of the program that proved financially insolvent.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, certainly for the MEEP program.
Not PEEP. No, I get
yeah, that. We're but that unless Minsure doesn't work out, we could always try MEEP again.
I thought of that. All right.
I know.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you.
Crazy.
So then the welcome. Paper for performance.
Uh-huh. My name is Kirsten Larson. I'm a budget officer with MMB. I'll be talking about the Pay for Performance Oversight Committee today. You should all have a letter from us that responds to the questions the committee posed, but I'll also just take a minute to talk through our responses. The committee provides the commissioner of MMB advice regarding the implementation of a pay for performance pilot program that was authorized in law during the 2011 session. The purpose of the pilot is to demonstrate the feasibility of using bonds to pay for services based on performance and outcomes that may take longer than a typical budget cycle to demonstrate, so longer than 2 years. This is an active committee, and we're still in the process of implementing the pilot, so it's still a work in progress. The work of the committee itself focuses on recommending service areas for the performance pilot, as well as helping us determine the performance metrics and the return on investment calculation for whatever resulting pay-for-performance contract might be signed. This committee has a pretty broad representation of stakeholders from the nonprofit and academic communities, state and local governments, and service providers, and has provided a really useful way for obtaining feedback, advice, and opinions from a variety of audiences that are going to be participating in the pilot. Given the pretty unique nature of this pilot, we think this committee provides a really good avenue for obtaining feedback from how the pilot is structured and for information sharing. Without the committee, I think MMB would still implement a similar kind of committee process to obtain the feedback we need to move forward with the pilot. So with that, I will stand for questions.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There were, in the report, it said there were currently two vacancies. If you could let us know what sectors and why they're open and if they will be filled shortly or...
I'll try to respond, Mr. Chair, members. Because of the nature of this pilot, the folks that have the capacity to assist us with it also ended up being many of the folks that were on the original oversight committee. I think we have two vacancies right now. One was vacated by Frank Forsberg of the Greater Twin Cities United Way after he recused himself because he will likely be participating as part of the pilot program. The second vacancy, I can't remember off the top of my head, but both of those vacancies are in the process of being refilled and should be refilled shortly.
Are there legislators on this?
There are legislators.
The House, because Nora Slavik was on it. And so we have now we've now appointed somebody. So I think that vacancy actually may be filled since this letter was published or whatever.
Thank you.
So what's the timing on this? When do we think we're going to see something, a pilot up and running?
So, Mr. Chair and members, the committee has identified two service areas that we're working on, one in the area of workforce development and one in the area of supportive housing. The commissioners of DEED and of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency are both in the process of beginning contract negotiations. We're hoping that those negotiations will be finished up by around the end of October, at which point we'd be able to actually start moving forward with the pilot.
Okay. And how big are each of those, dollar-wise, I guess? Yeah.
Sure. So right now, Mr. Chair and members, it would depend on... the size of the pilot will depend on the capacity that the commissioners working in conjunction with the nonprofit partners think fits best. The initial legislation authorized $10 million in bond authority. Right now we're looking at each pilot being in the size of anywhere from $2.5 to $5 million.
Other questions? Yeah, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The letter that we have received indicates no reports have been issued by the committee yet, and I understand it's new and you're working on it, but Would I be correct, given the fact you're going to be issuing grants and $10 million has been authorized, would it be correct that at some point the group is going to issue a report with recommendations, and is there a requirement in the initial legislation that report come back to the legislature for us to take a look at?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is a report required to be filed by January 15th of 2014, I believe, at which point the activities of the committee would be disseminated back to the legislature.
And presumably, since it's a pilot program, we'll see how it actually works in delivering services, and that'll come back to us as well.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Revenue, is that who's next? Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Susan Von Lush, Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue. I am going to speak with you today about the first item on the agenda, the Property Tax Working Group, and I have with me Paul Wilson, Director of Tax Research, and Eric Ouellette, Director of Property Tax Research, to talk with you about the second item, the Tax Information Sample Data Committee. The Property Tax Working Group was created as part of the Omnibus Tax Bill in 2010. The mission of the group was to investigate ways to simplify Minnesota's property tax system and to make advisory recommendations on ways to make the system more understandable. The legislation identified membership of the committee. It included representatives appointed by the House of Representatives Tax Committee and the Senate Tax Committee, along with representatives from the Association of Minnesota Counties, the League of Cities, the Association of Townships, the Chamber of Commerce, the Association of Assessing Officers, and individual homeowners, as well as a jointly appointed representative from the Minnesota Farm Bureau and the Minnesota Farmers Union. The group held approximately 20 meetings between October of 2010 and November 2012. The most recent meetings were listed in the attachment that was on the website. They were in September, October, and November of 2012. And the group did receive, they did not have a budget. However, they did receive support from the Department of Revenue in terms of the property tax division, provided a significant amount of staffing and support to the group as they received background in the structure of Minnesota's property tax system and how it works, and as they work through developing recommendations. The document that you have in front of you also lists the website. This is the final report that the group issued in November of 2012. It is on our website, and the report was heard by both the Senate and House Tax Committees during the 2013 session. I believe, looking at this, that this language is codified in statute. And looking back over the history of this, I believe the reason it was in statute as opposed to session law is because this provision that it's in Section 270C.991, the year that was enacted, there were some additional benchmarks and some additional requirements put in the session law in terms of how we do the information we provide in our revenue estimates for property taxes. And I believe at the time that this was kind of a package, and that's why this study was codified. I do believe that given the fact that the working group has completed its work and that the report has been issued, that language could probably be removed from statute.
Any questions? Discussion on that one? Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now the really exciting stuff.
Yeah. Mr. Chair,
members of the commission. For the record, Paul Wilson, Tax Research Director at the Department of Revenue. And we'll talk about the Tax Information Sample Data Committee. This committee was established in 1988 at the same time as the birth of the current income tax model, the House Income Tax Simulation Model, abbreviated often HITS. The membership represents the Department of Revenue, the State Economist Group at MMB, and the legislature, the tax committees in the legislature. The sample and model that are talked about in here are used for several different purposes. They're used by MMB, by the State Economist Office, for the forecast of future income tax revenues. The sample and model are used to estimate the impact of proposed changes in income tax law for revenue estimates. And they're used to conduct other analysis at the Department of Revenue, including the tax incidence study and I think some connection with some other studies as well. A new income tax sample is created by Department of Revenue every year, and the model is updated each year as well for changes in tax law and other modifications. That update is done currently and has been, I think, since the beginning, done by the House, because this is the House income tax simulation model. And Ms. Nina Manzi at the House has been the person who does most of the actual updating of the model. So the goals of the committee are just to make sure that the needs of all three groups of the users of the model are met, DOR, MMB, and the legislative tax committees, to monitor how the income tax sample is modified through time. We have made major modifications because of increased electronic filing over this period of time. And, of course, there are always changes in tax variables that are needed for the analysis. So making sure we pick up the variables that are needed for the analysis so that we have what we need. You always have some oddballs like the Ponzi scheme losses a couple years that really take a lot of time to figure out what to do with in the model and the sample. Another goal of the committee is just to review how the tax model is adjusted for changes in federal and state law. There's a meeting that is not actually listed as a group, but I think it is a meeting of this group technically every year to go over those parameters with exactly the same people to make sure that the parameters of the model are being set properly for changes in income tax law, both federal and state. The group has no budget, and the work is done, basically, is essential work. I would say the communication and cooperation between the groups who are represented in the committee is critical for good budget policy for the state, and I think the committee has met its goals and continues to meet its goals.
Any discussion on this one?
Mr. Speaker and Dr. Wilson, nice to see you, and Ms. Van Mosch and Mr. Ouellette. And I certainly can't speak for Senator Bach, but he may want to chime in as a former tax chair. You know, I'm not sure, you know, in reading kind of the information we got backed up on your work, you know, there's these meetings and that are listed, and there's occasionally a report. But as Dr. Wilson just said, the real work's what they're doing all the time that you don't see on here. And, you know, I think Senator Bach would agree with me that this group, this microdata group, is kind of unknown to folks who don't serve on taxes. But it's one of the most important groups the state has, in my estimation, for doing the right nonpartisan budgetary work. And I just, you know, a little background. I first was exposed to it when Speaker Swigum had appointed former Representative Abrams to chair the Tax Committee, and Governor Plenty and Representative Abrams really decided they were going to overhaul the tax system in 2001. And it was a bipartisan effort with the Democratic Senate, and learned that this group met in this little cave in the bottom of the Senate somewhere. And really, the work these people are doing is, you know, the public should know, is some of the most nonpartisan work we see in the legislature. We're fortunate to have these people, many of them who've been doing this for 25 or 30 years under multiple governors, multiple parties, and they're really able to set aside who's got a dog in the fight, what are the politics, to try to bring us the best possible numbers to make our decisions, whether no matter who's in charge. And I think that it's a group of people that is not recognized by the legislature, doesn't understand. It's really making, at its bottom line, from the tax perspective, the way I always view the group is, They're making sure the assumptions are right in modeling so the House, Senate, and the governor are on the same page. We may all go on to fight like we always do, but they're really doing the underlying data work in a way that legislators can, they can all collectively, you know, all of us together can say, yeah, that's right, kind of the numbers we're getting to. And I don't know how, you know, this even gets on the list as sort of a temporary group, quite frankly, because they're so integral to our work. And I think the property tax working group, and again, you know, I'd be interested to hear what Senator Bach thinks, they seem done to me, and that should be closed up and moved on. But the microdata group within the House, Senate, and the executive branch is so critical to our work that I hate to even view it as a kind of a temporary group. So I never think of it that way.
Mr. Chair, I would point out in the language, in 2009, the legislature actually changed the temporary nature of the group, and there is a subdivision 5 which now states that that this group shall not expire. So I would say that this group, is, unless you change something this coming session, this group would be an ongoing group. And we, as an agency, would recommend that or would suggest that not be changed.
So why just income and property taxes?
Modeling.
Or do you model sales taxes or not?
Mr. Chair, the income tax, they say, again, this dates back to 1988, so it was actually part of the creation of the income tax sample. There is something in the language that talks about bringing in some property taxes and other information. That is being done within the Department of Revenue and property tax same groups. There's property tax burden study that's done. The sample, the income tax data is used, but not the sample for that study. We have the incident study, which brings in all the other taxes and which starts with the income tax sample. But this group, the technical nature of this group, is really limited to making sure the income tax sample works. There is a property tax group as well that Mr. Willett talked about. But this has been set up as being only income tax because that's sort of is a core that MMB needs to have.
And this is not for you. It's on the spending side. Have we ever done anything like this with, like, the Department of Human Services, where the modeling is actually where we come together and agree on what the underlying assumptions of the modeling ought to be? Is anybody aware of that? I mean, it seems actually like not a bad... Okay. Anyway. Any other questions? Representative Holbert, did you have questions on this one?
Well, Mr. Chair, I concur with Representative Lencheski. When the legislature is contemplating changes in the income tax system, it is critical that the changes that are proposed can be scored so that we know how much money a proposed change would bring in or how much it would not bring in. So it's pretty critical work, and I certainly support the current law and their continuation.
Mr. Chair, there is also a subgroup of this group, which is the property tax microdata group.
Did you want to mention anything about that?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Eric Ouellette, the property tax research director at the Department of Revenue. And our property tax group does similar work to the income tax group. We just want to make sure that when we're modeling proposals, all the numbers agree between what the House, the Senate, and the Department come up with. And we spend a lot of time talking about the assumptions that should go into how we do that modeling to keep it as consistent as possible. And it worked pretty well.
Yes, Mr.
Chair, Mr. Willett, I remember at one time that property tax group anticipated that every dollar that we put into local government aid provided 50 cents of property tax relief at the local level. And then I remember that was changed. Right. And for those of you that aren't on the tax committee, Mr. Willett, what's the current status of the modeling for that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, it was actually 2/3 was the assumption many years ago, and we changed it maybe 3 years ago to 50% based on the behavior that we saw. When the recession hit, changes to the aid programs didn't have as big of an impact on property taxes as they had historically, so we had to adjust our assumption to try and match what we are seeing with the experience with local governments. And those assumptions are something that we review every year at the beginning of the session to make, and those assumptions govern how we model any proposed changes during that session.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. IT. Minutes, I guess, right?
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Eichten. I am the Legislative Director for the Office of Minute Services, formerly the Office of Enterprise Technology. We have four advisory committees to discuss here today related to Minute. The first one is the Advisory Committee for Technology Standards for Accessibility and Usability. This committee sunsetted in June of this year. It's now a part of the internal Minute governance structure. This is a structure we've implemented as part of the IT consolidation effort, so it informs, aligns decision-making around IT in many areas, architecture projects, standards, strategic planning, and now accessibility is one of those areas. Minute did accept the committee's recommendation to add two community seats to the committee, so recognizing the community at large are also stakeholders, and these seats provide them with a view into our decision-making process, a way to provide advice and input. So our chief information accessibility officer, Jay Wyant, is planning to be here to speak in more detail. I don't see him here yet, so if it's all right, I might just move on to the next committee, and if he returns, bring him up.
Sure. So this is gone, though, now?
It has sunsetted. We're very happy with it as part of our internal governance structure. The chair of the group, David Andrews, is here as well, if you'd like him to speak to that. But we're hoping that this is going to be a much more fluid way for the group to provide advice and input on an ongoing basis.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've internalized a similar group under your standards is what I'm hearing.
The same group and then added two community members. Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay, and if I might, as it was put together was about accessibility, et cetera, and as I shared with Senator Lori, I watched the hearing last week and heard what great things MinIT is doing relative to the new infrastructure that's being built around MinSure, but was curious when you have a new system and all of this data and, for example, the situation with using the publicly available agent's license number as the password to log into a system for training. Does this group advise I know when you were created there was a lot of worry about how heavy-handed you'd be into what existing agencies, et cetera, all having their own IT people mm-hmm. and how this was all going to work. But with something like, coming fresh out of the ground and I'm just concerned what role or, input or role did your group have? Does your new internal group talk about protocols to avoid those kinds of problems? How does this work?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first I would say, that isn't necessarily an accessibility issue, so I don't know that the accessibility committee would have had any input into the internal procedures that MinSure uses to sign up folks for, whatever continuing education or whatever it might be. As we grow our governance process, the hope would be that most IT decision-making would flow through it, and the accessibility committee would be keyed in to each of those decisions. But I think the issues you're bringing up are more around the area of security, and those would fall to the security committee. Jay is here. So I don't know if Jay has anything to say as far as his involvement with MNsure decision making, but I don't see that it really as an accessibility issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought I was clear and that I knew that it wasn't an accessibility issue, but that you have internalized this group. And from your answer, I'm guessing you now have more than one internal group. You've got like a security group and an accessibility group. And so maybe a little bit about how those are functioning. And
so, Mr. Chair, Representative, the Information Standards and Risk Management Committee would be the group that would look at these issues. As far as their functioning, though, I don't believe that a business decision as far as what information would be collected for continuing education would have gone through the security governance.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not communicating clearly this morning.
And I apologize if I'm not understanding.
I mean, a pretty simple standard of security is you don't use a publicly available number as a password. You know, I think that's pretty, I think probably fifth and sixth graders are taught that when they're first generating passwords to log on to things. So to what degree does your security or your internal systems advise and or have ability to monitor or set standards throughout state government as we're upgrading these systems? I mean, you're supposed to be the new shining, you know, star and get everybody up to so we can hopefully get the public sector somewhere near where private sector is and standards and protocols. And you seem to be doing things internally. You don't need us to tell you what kind of task force, et cetera, you need. But how are you addressing these kinds of issues structurally within your organization?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there are a few different pieces here. One would be overall the architecture of our systems and how we're setting those up, the security that's being baked in around those systems, especially as we modernize them. The second piece, and I think we're getting at that line between security and sort of data practices. And as far as what, if any, involvement Minute had in the decision around using that particular piece of information as a password, I can't speak to that. I can look into it. But I can say that we have policies and standards that require encryption in transmission of any kind of non-public data. I just can't speak to any standards that would be around for business leaders or business, the program areas, what kind of information should be used for passwords that they distribute to their stakeholders. I just don't believe that Minute policies or standards get into that area, but I'd be happy to look into it further and check back in with you.
Okay. So just on this one, so how do we know if standards for accessibility and usability are being met? And the task force is gone and you're internalizing it. But what do you look for?
Mr. Chair, members, the two components, the advisory board is helping me craft strategic practice. So what we're trying to do here is identify what are the primary issues, what are the primary potential problems that I, as the Chief Information Accessibility Officer, should be focusing on. And so they were helping to create strategic direction. And because the advisory board comprises of members of 10 agencies, plus two to be named outside Republic members, those people will have an awareness of issues or problems, either for personal or agency issues. That will create advice for me to then I can then drive tactical action toward that. So that kind of the direction to strategic body on the more acting logistical, tactical office to carry out that strategy. And then.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you. With going from a task force model where I'm assuming you had your meeting minutes and agendas published and the public could attend to a more internal structure, do we lose the ability of the public or interested organizations to participate in this process?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe being out of statute would officially not require certain restrictions to be met around open meetings. The case with this group would be that we would want the broadest input possible, and moving forward, I believe we're going to be promulgating these meetings as far and wide as we can using Jay's channels, the stakeholders of the committee members. We did just add two new public members, so you know, I believe officially, yes, it does change since it's out of statute. However, we're going to be behaving in the same way that we've always behaved to try and solicit the broadest input possible.
All right, thank you.
Fair question, generally speaking, though. I mean, not just for this one. Yeah. Okay, thank you, and good to see you.
Mr. Chair, the next group is the E-Government Advisory Council. This council has yet to be appointed. We have had some strong applicants representing state agencies, business community, and what I'll call the open data, open government sort of community. This council's model after similar councils that other states use to provide advice and recommendation on the development of new online government services. So it will vet proposals for new online services and prioritize them for development. The council will also provide oversight on any associated transaction fees that are applied and used to fund development of new services. And the hope would be for that first meeting to occur in November of this year. Moving on, the Geospatial Information Advisory.
Mr. Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on this one, I noted that there's no local government representatives, and yet there's so much interaction between cities and counties and school districts with state services. Sometimes they're actually, you know, I mean, I think of counties where you renew your driver's license at their site versus somewhere else. And, you know, it seems to me that you might want to consider adding that because every time the state changes a system, it has ripple effects on all our local government partners. And I don't see their voice in this listing, if I'm understanding correctly what the group is tasked to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I would agree. It would be a very helpful group to have on the council. We do have a county representative on our technology advisory committee and unique perspective. We didn't include a local government representative on this group. Perhaps we'll see that as an oversight in the months to come, and I'm sure we would be open to including local government on the group as well.
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate your considering that because I just know in some areas of service, the locals are actually ahead of the state, and their knowledge and experience with some of these sorts, upgrading some of these services, and I think both would benefit from understanding what each other's doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's certainly been the case with our Technology Advisory Committee and as well as the Geospatial Committee that Dan will be speaking about shortly.
And this one does expire in 2017.
Yes, correct, sir. Okay. The next council is the Geospatial Information Advisory Council. It's important to note that before last session, Minute actually hosted two Geospatial Information Advisory Councils. We did advance legislation in 2013 to eliminate the state agency Geospatial Advisory Council and then change some membership requirements for the existing council to allow more state agency representation and be sort of a broad, balanced group. Our Chief Geospatial Information Officer, Dan Ross, is here to speak in more detail about that group.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, this committee was created by the advocacy of the state member community and the stakeholder groups throughout the state in 2009. It's a very active committee. We meet four times a year, but there's additional things that happen in between those meetings that the committee advises on. You can see, I believe you have a document that identifies the makeup of the committee, and you can see how diverse that committee is. Represents state government, federal government, local government, both counties and cities. It represents academia, represents nonprofits. So we are a very diverse committee that really represents the the interests of the broader community as it relates to geospatial in the state of Minnesota. It's a very collaborative science, so obtaining this input is important to what MinGeo, Minnesota Geospatial Information Office, does. You also have a list of our priority projects in that same document. Those were advised by this council. So we are aligning our activities with what the broader community wants and with what the state agencies want as well. So it's a forum to bring the brain trust, the collective brain trust of the broader geospatial community together through a council.
What do we do with this stuff?
We mostly create data sets. If you look at that project list, you can see that consider NextGen 911. That's coming up. We need to have statewide parcels, statewide center lines, and all of those. Right now, there's several organizations that create those. Imagine 87 different parcelators from 87 different counties. Well, this council advises to bring that together into one, and they advise the standards that will stand up behind that. Same thing with shared center lines. Many folks create their own center lines. We're moving towards one standard, one system where we can all manage in a single system, but yet they maintain control over their local data. Many of those sources are local government. So
it's largely a standard-setting entity?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, it's an advising more than standard-setting. The Geospatial Technical Committee, which is
And I don't mean just the advisory committee. I mean not just the advisory committee. What does the entity do?
MinGeo.
Geospatial, yes.
So Dan's office, the Minnesota Geospatial Information Office.
Yes. So yeah. You set standards and then collect the data sets.
We do, Mr. Chair, we do set standards on behalf of state agencies. We don't have the power to enforce in the broader community, but that's what this council is for. They advocate for that standard statewide. So they're not only our input stream, they're also our communication stream back to those broad sectors that I've identified earlier.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's come to my attention that maybe we're as a state falling behind in an area which is really about using GIS data for research and analysis of effectiveness of programs or what trends are happening, and that we don't have, I've heard that we don't have common standards across state agencies on what information is geocoded, what isn't, and that we don't really use that in a way that we could to actually affect program outcomes. And the examples that you give here lead me to think that this is really focused on mapping for like public works projects and natural resources sort of stuff. And when I'm looking for data, for example, for Hennepin County, where 25% of the state's population lives, so many state agencies, when you give a big bunch of information like that, if it isn't geocoded, you really can't see what's happening because there's 47 different communities that are very diverse. And that some state agencies are really stepping up to this, and others you wait 2 years to even just get some very basic data that the state's collecting in old-fashioned ways, and you don't get real-time sort of stuff. Even just on our legacy dollars, the information that's available on the website is by county, which, you know, in a county, when we have counties of 6,000 and we have counties with a fourth of the population, doesn't work. And it seems like the solution to that is to get GIS used consistently in the gathering of all kinds of data. And is this group starting to look at that sort of bigger picture? Because that would really help us as we're planning programs, evaluating programs on not just the physical end, but a lot more the person services.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, this group does look at that. If you look at that list of projects, they are ones that they've advocated for, and they are statewide projects, and each of those will require a standard. In addition, this group works closely with our Geospatial Technical Committee, which is our internal policy setting committee, and they identify standards that are needed. So, for instance, we have metadata standards that in order to share geospatial data in Minnesota, they have to meet that standard. They've also advocated for something that we call the Minnesota Geospatial Commons, where we're building a common storefront for all state agencies and local governments and nonprofits to put their geospatial information in a standard form so we can share it in a common storefront. This is an activity that came out of this advisory council, as well as others, the broader stakeholder community.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, recognizing some of the challenges that you raised to data sharing around GIS and difficulty and, frankly, even between local governments and state governments and state agencies in negotiating data sharing agreements, working out licensing agreements. It's one of the reasons that we did put forward and passed a bill last session to require sharing at no cost between government entities to sort of lay the groundwork for the geospatial commons that Dan's talking about and make it easier for local governments, members of the public, state agencies to share, access shared data on a single site with, you know, applications that are embedded into that site to be able to do some of the visualization that you're talking about around public programs. And this gets at even generally data governance as a state. How do we better make decisions in order to share our data and bring out the underlying trends and phenomena at work and make better decisions? And geospatial data is certainly a big piece of that and something that Dan's group is excited about on local and state level.
Well, and Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, and I'd really be interested in working with you and anyone else who's interested, I really have struggled, and I had a geography intern for free until I got offered a paid one, and then I lost him, who was going to help me sort out, because so much of the information we get from state agencies is metro as one big blob, and then Greater Minnesota is divided into 4 to 10 different groupings, depending upon which state agency, which program. I mean, there's no consistency across state agencies, even in Greater Minnesota. And for Metro, with its complexity and with its, you know, its issues, just giving summary data by Metro isn't working. And so we really do need to figure out how to get more sophisticated in just kind of how we put together and share summary data for us as decision makers. And we need something like this to work across state agencies to force them to look at why do we have the groupings that we have. Would better consistent groupings across agencies make more sense? And you know, so that we can actually, as decision makers, really understand what's going on.
So are there people in the private sector that are issuing standards that compete with the standards that you are working on?
Mr. Chair, primarily the standards that we work with come out of the federal government or are here driven by state government. So the private sector is really not proffering a lot of standards that...
Do we have access to this data? Private businesses?
Private businesses do have access to the geospatial data in Minnesota, yes. The state data. They have access to the local data, but they can be charged for that still.
Okay. And that's free of charge for state data?
It is free of charge for state data, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You have one more?
We do have one more. Mr. Chair, the last committee is the Technology Advisory Committee. This was mandated with the passage of the IT Consolidation Law in 2011. Committee serves, it's a very effective sounding board and offers critical advice as we plan and implement changes in the delivery of IT services across the state. Membership includes state agency business leaders, your commissioner, deputy level, folks, as well as representation from the private sector and local government. Provides business leaders some early indication of our strategic tactical direction. Where there have been concerns, we've been able to adjust our course or change our communication strategy where necessary. The private sector representation, our chair is actually Rick King from Thomson Reuters, provides some unique insight from industries that have already gone through similar consolidation processes. In general, it's been highly effective, efficient means of obtaining input and feedback, and we would, again, recommend that this committee be continued.
Representative Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eichten, it looks like there's only six people on it. You think it's big enough in its current makeup? I was looking at what was included in our packet, that there are only six people and one member appointed to represent private business.
Six state agency and then one local government, one private business, and then the state chief information officer.
Okay, so then my follow-up to that is there enough private business representation if there's only one?
I think for the, Mr. Chair, Senator Steven, for the needs of this committee, having at least one private sector person, I believe one meets the needs. At the same time, we've been having discussions internally about seeking a broader group of private sector CIOs who could offer advice and input. IT consolidation is still an ongoing process, and we see there's potentially some very valuable insight that they could offer. So whether it's statutorily mandated or something that we seek informally, the advice of the private sector in consolidating IT services is very appreciated.
Okay. So it says one of the missions is development of a state information technology strategic plan. Does that exist?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is both a state IT master plan and then a minute strategic plan for the state IT organization. Those were both published in 2012.
Okay. Any other questions on this one? Okay. Thank you. So, you know, one thing we could do here is proceed, you know, kind of like the Pension Commission does sometimes and start to assemble a bill like provision by provision, and then at the end of the day the whole thing would come back as a consolidated bill and we'd all vote on that at the end as well. I mean, I assume this is just going to be a recommendation that goes out and then each of the different committees, we'll have to think through that. But there, it seems like there's a couple that we could just kind of put on the table today if people are interested in, just so maybe the easiest way to track what we're doing. And I was thinking, so the PEEP and the MEEP, it sounds like there's some fairly broad consensus to eliminate those groups. The Higher Education Veterans Assistance Steering Committee has served its purpose, and I think they recommended that piece go. As with the Property Tax Working Group, which has issued its report. And there's some other work that needs to be done probably around some of these other groups, but I don't know if we're quite ready there. But do we want to just put those four on the list of things that we'll... Senator Hand.
On that list, you might want to add the Veterans Health Care Advisory Council.
We should take it out of statute. I think it's expired already, but that's a good point. Okay. And there was one more that's expired. I guess that first one, the Accessibility and Usability Committee for MnIT, I think just expired in June.
Yeah.
So basically it's that Accessibility and Usability, the Property Tax Working Group, PEEP, MEEP Advisory Councils, the Veterans Healthcare Advisory Council, and the Higher Education Veterans Assistance Steering Committee. Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not adverse to that, but I do think we should have some discussion around to the degree that agencies internalize processes and they no longer have the protections and the sunshine of an open meeting standard and a decision-making process. I mean, I think it's worth some discussion.
Sure. How should we do that?
Hopefully not today.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's bringing someone in to actually talk about what the rules are on what the differences would be, what the authority is.
Well, Mr. Or do we know? Chair, I don't think there are any rules.
There are.
If they're going to do an internal working group, they can have meetings wherever, whenever, without them being noticed. They probably don't have to keep minutes, where if you are a publicly created task force or whatever, then you're subject to the open meeting law, you're subject to some accessibility for the public to attend and find out what an agenda would look like. So I would just caution people as we move forward here, if we set the precedent where all the way to get out of the sunshine is to wait till something expires, say, oh, we've internalized it, and then you can manage it however you want. I'm not sure that that's a good precedence either.
Well, let's take the accessibility and usability one off the list. I think the rest of them are truly expired groups. So is that? I think it's a very good point. And it's probably a question we should ask everybody as they come through here, too. So Property Tax Working Group, the two MEEP and PEEP, and the two veterans ones, which I think have all expired or their work has been completed.
So is the goal then to take action so that when a bill is ultimately drafted, these would be included?
Right. Yes. So we'll kind of put them on the table. They can start drafting stuff, and then the whole bill would come back to us ultimately.
Are you looking for a motion
yes.
at this point? Well, I'd like to move with that one exception the list that the chair recommended.
Well, right. Mr. Chair.
Yep. Senator Stevenson.
I'm just a little bit concerned then to that point that Representative Holberg raised about the Veterans Health Care Advisory Council. It sounds like the commissioner is going to internalize it and make a lot of good work on that, but I do think that some of those meetings possibly – we won't, and I'm sure they will, but that they're posted and that they're, there's the ability for the public to know what's happening. And so
that one expired, but we could recommend that it continue.
Right. Oh, I see what you're saying. So that it would still, it's expired, but that because the commissioner made.
That one just expired for whatever reason. The time ran out on it. That whatever sunset we set 4 years ago ran on June 30th. So another recommendation, we could just take that one off the list for now if we want to kind of consider what we want to do in that area, because it is subject to other discussions at the Capitol right now, too. Mm-hmm. You want to amend your motion on that?
Yeah, well, okay. Right. Just leave. It would be the other three that...
There's four left.
Or four that are remaining then.
Okay. All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. So I will let Senator Newman and Representative Holberg and a volunteer from the Senate DFL caucus to get together, and then we'll get together and meet here in a smaller group and then kind of sort this out a little bit more. Anything else that people have? All right. Then we are adjourned.